four hostages rescued from Hamas.
The four hostages were held in two separate apartments in the Nusayrat refugee camp. The three men who were rescued were apparently being held by a former Hamas spokesman who was also a sometimes journalist.
Plus, right-wing gains in EU elections.
And it will just change the way the EU does business. It will be much more populist and much more right than it will be left.
And later, Ukraine strikes a Russian warplane inside Russian territory, and a look at American businesses being targeted in Iraq. Today is Monday, June 10th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was back in the Middle East on Monday to meet with leaders in Egypt and Israel in a push to achieve a halt in fighting. This comes after an Israeli raid in Nusayrat this weekend that freed four hostages held captive by Hamas, while at the same time leaving over 200 Palestinians dead. And Benny Gantz, a political opponent of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and also a member of his war cabinet, resigned from government on Sunday. To help us digest all this, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Well, Israeli officials say that it was based on intelligence that was gathered over weeks, apparently with help from the United States. It happened during the daytime, and the four hostages were held in two separate apartments in the Nusayrat refugee camp. The three men who were rescued were apparently being held by a former Hamas spokesman who was also a sometimes journalist. He's contributed to various outlets. And Israel says that it actually changed the timing of the raid several times to try to avoid killing civilians. All four hostages, actually former hostages, seem to be in fairly good condition. They were held, again, in residential homes rather than in the tunnels underground. They seem to be in good health. And in one of the sort of sad things of this is that the father of one of the Israeli young men hostages died a few hours before his son was freed, and he apparently died of a broken heart.
Ugh. What do we know about the number of Palestinians killed, and who were they? Were they fighting the Israelis who were on their way to rescue the hostages, or were they just civilians in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Well, it seems to be a combination of both of those. There was fighting between the special forces soldiers who came into these apartments and the male family members who were in these apartments. But the raid was also accompanied by pretty heavy airstrikes. Palestinians say more than 200 people were killed, but they don't give the breakdown between civilians and fighters. Israel says that it did everything it can to limit the number of civilians killed, but that when the hostages were being held in residential buildings, you know, Hamas is in effect using the population as human shields.
As if that wasn't enough to talk about, Benny Gantz, one of the members of the cabinet, has resigned. What does this mean for Netanyahu? What does this mean for the Israeli government?
Well, so Benny Gantz had warned 3 weeks ago that if there weren't some changes made in the way that Netanyahu was handling the war, meaning moving forward on a ceasefire deal that would release the hostages and coming up with some kind of a plan for the day after the war ends in Gaza, and also passing a law that would lead to the ultra-Orthodox in Israel being drafted, which is a really big hot-button issue here, that he would leave the government on June 8th. That's the day that these hostages were released, so he postponed his announcement by a day. But last night, he did say that he's leaving the government. Netanyahu still has a majority in the government. Israel's Knesset has 120 members, and Netanyahu now, even after Benny Gantz left, has 64. In Israel, it's a parliamentary democracy, meaning you vote for the party, not for the person. And then the party with the largest number of votes puts together a coalition, in this case, Netanyahu's Likud. but he has partnered with two extremist parties that we've talked about quite a bit, headed by Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir. And in some ways, Benny Gantz leaving gives them more power because he now needs them for his government to continue. And they have said they would pull out of the government and bring it down if he goes ahead with a ceasefire deal.
And your reporting has also turned up a possible separate American deal with Hamas. What do we know about that?
Well, it's based on both Israeli and American press reports that the United States is kind of losing patience with Netanyahu and his refusal to move forward. Last Friday, if you remember, President Biden announced this new ceasefire proposal, which he says is Israel's proposal. And then Israel kind of said, well, hemmed and hawed a little bit. Hamas has not officially answered yet. And the idea would be that Qatar, which has been negotiating the ceasefire until now, would negotiate some sort of a separate deal with Hamas that would lead to the freedom of the five American Israeli hostages who were still believed to be alive, including Hirsch Goldberg Poland, the son of my friends Rachel and John, and also three of the bodies of American Israelis who were killed on October 7th, and their bodies have been kidnapped into Gaza. And I think, you know, what Hamas would gain is a certain amount of legitimacy that it's negotiating kind of as an equal partner with the United States. But whether or not that's enough for Hamas without some kind of a ceasefire, which apparently would not be being negotiated because the United States can't promise a ceasefire, but it does increase pressure on Israel to say yes to the ceasefire deal.
VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for taking the time to talk with us on what sounds like a very busy day indeed.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
And in Ukraine, Kyiv says that it struck one of Russia's most advanced warplanes inside Russia. VOA's Lori London speaks with correspondent Anna Chernakova in Kyiv for more.
Yeah, so we're hearing that actually Ukrainian forces are either damaging or destroying a number of targets on the territory of Russia. This includes the warjet, this includes the warship as well, and also other targets in Russia. And this comes along with the information that Ukraine is getting more weapons from its allies, and also that Ukraine is actually getting agreement on using these weapons on the territory of Russia. And according to international experts and according to number of international media outlets, Ukraine is actually using the weapons provided by the West to strike such targets on the territory of Russia. Also, according to Ukrainian officials and Ukrainian military, Ukraine also used its own weapons to attack targets which Ukraine cannot attack with the Western weapons. And this also creates additional, let's say, window of opportunities for Ukrainian forces.
There is obviously still intense fighting. It sounds like there were quite a bit of devastating weekend drone attacks.
Yes, drone and missile attacks continue, fighting continue, and actually we're talking here about the whole front line. According to the latest update, situation in the Kharkiv region is more or less stable, at least more stable than it used to be weeks ago. More attacks are happening in the Donetsk region, and also Ukrainian authorities report that certain actions are happening on the border with Sumy region, and this goes in line with what Russian forces did in the Kharkiv region, because as we can see, Russian forces created a certain buffer zone and continue to try to advance within this buffer zone in the Kharkiv region. And accordingly, there is a big fear, Ukrainian officials announced this last week, that Russian forces will try to do the same in the Sumy region, just to have this longer line of buffer zone which will connect Donetsk and Kharkiv and Sumy regions. In the Donetsk region, we get information that Ukrainian forces managed to stabilize the situation in certain areas, and Russian forces managed to enter the first line of the Chasovy Yar village, which is a place of the fierce fighting at this point.
And I know they're hopeful that, you know, the Western military aid will start coming in and they'll be able to ramp up their own defense efforts. But how are Ukrainians reacting and feeling about the EU two elections over the weekend?
The results of the elections looks quite positive for Ukraine. The European People's Party, which is very friendly and very pro-Ukrainian oriented, has most of the seats. And according to Ursula von der Leyen, she said that European Parliament will continue this pro-European and pro-Ukrainian work in the upcoming years, which is definitely positive for Ukraine. And it was certain, intimidation whether the elections will go smooth from the Ukrainian point of view in terms of Ukrainian interests. We can see that in some countries, number of parties which do not demonstrate support for Ukraine did not succeed. In some countries, such parties actually had success. So nevertheless, the main result looks positive at this point for Ukraine, and Ukraine hopes that this will definitely increase the support and weapons coming to Ukraine, especially in this upcoming months of summer, which is supposed to be quite active in terms of the battle.
All right. Anna Chernikova reporting to us from Kyiv. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori.
Lori London hosts Flashpoint Ukraine here on The Voice of America. She was speaking with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Elsewhere in Europe, far-right parties made gains in the European Parliament election on Sunday, adding uncertainty to the EU's future political direction. Despite the far-right's inroads, the center-right European People's Party will still be the biggest political family in the new legislature. That's good news for Ursula von der Leyen as she seeks a second five-year term at the helm of the European Commission.
The center is holding. But it is also true that the extremes on the left and on the right have gained support. And this is why the result comes with great responsibility for the parties in the center. We may differ on individual points, but we all have an interest in stability. And we all want a strong and effective Europe.
Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron unexpectedly called for a snap national election after his party was battered by Marine Le Pen's far right-wing party in the EU balloting. Macron acknowledged that the EU result was grim for his government and one he could not ignore. For a deeper dive into the EU elections, my colleague Scott Walterman spoke with political consultant Matt Klink.
We do know that the populist far-right parties have won record support this year through early exit polls. While these parties made gains, some of the more liberal or progressive parties certainly did not, and that the center-right also gained. Which is referred to as the European People's Party, and they are likely to have the most seats in the European Parliament in the future, and it will just change the way the EU does business. It will be much more populist and much more right than it will be left.
The People's Party is von der Leyen's party, and you are right. They they're going to take the most of the seats in the Parliament, the center right. So she now has to balance. Does she have to shift at all, change, build a coalition?
Well, it's essential for any European country politics, but definitely for the EU Parliament. Definitely, she'll have to make a broad-based coalition. It will be interesting because the far-right identity and democracy groups made major gains. And I know that some other center and center-left parties, they likely won't even want to be in the same government if the far-right is included. But it will be very, very difficult to exclude the far-right identity and democracy groups from government because of their strong showing.
Scott Walterman hosts International Edition here on The Voice of America. He was speaking with Matt Klink. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from The Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. American businesses are being targeted in Iraq. That story coming up in a moment. First, though, more election news. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is heading a coalition government as he begins a third term in office. His dependence on regional allies has raised questions over how effectively he'll be able to pursue transformational changes that he promised ahead of the elections. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi is only the second Indian leader to secure a third term. But he returns with a diminished mandate. With his party losing its majority in parliament, he heads a coalition government and will need wider agreement with his alliance partners. At a meeting with his allies on Friday, Modi said that a majority is essential to run the country. That's the essence of democracy. But he said to run a country, consensus is also essential. That consensus with regional allies poses challenges for an assertive leader who ruled with an absolute majority for a decade. Neerja Chaudhary is a political analyst.
His style of functioning has been take quick decisions, go into an issue, give a timeline for it to be implemented. It's not into consulting, you know, scores of people, taking them along in that decision-making process. So that will require a new approach.
At election rallies, Modi had said he had prepared a 100-day plan to pursue big targets. Now questions are being raised about how much he can achieve. Analysts say he will be able to carry his allies along in pursuing reforms to spur manufacturing and investment needed to grow India's economy. The country's push to build closer ties with neighboring countries and the United States while retaining relations with Russia also has broad consensus. Chaudhary again.
Big decisions on the economic front. They're opening up certain sectors to FDI. He may not confront much of a resistance there. Whether it's on the foreign policy front, he may take the allies along and he may well take the opposition along also.
But his party's Hindu nationalist agenda could take a backseat. His main allies belong to secular parties and do not share the BJP's Hindu-first ideology. Analysts also point out that the inauguration of a grand Hindu temple in Ayodhya in January failed to yield dividends. His party lost the seat where the temple is located. Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay is a political analyst and has authored a biography of Modi.
Verdict of 2024 is in fact a kind of rejection of extreme Hindu nationalistic policies. It did not actually become an electoral issue that people did not really vote for the BJP because they had got the temple constructed.
In a country where opposition parties have raised concerns of democratic backsliding under Modi, he will also need to build consensus with the re-energized opposition that has gained ground. Analysts say it remains to be seen how Modi, who critics have called authoritarian, adapts to India's new political landscape. Mukhopadhyay again.
Mr. Modi will have to reinvent himself if he wants this government to continue and, you know, last its full term without any major political upheavals.
How Modi navigates his third term will define the legacy of a leader who has towered over India in the last decade. Anjana Pasricha, VOA News, New Delhi.
The Iraqi government says it arrested several rioters who attacked and vandalized a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant in Baghdad last Monday. It was the latest in a series of incidents in Iraq in which masked men have sought to damage or intimidate U.S.-affiliated businesses. The Associated Press cites two officials of Iranian-backed militias saying their supporters carried out the assaults in retaliation for U.S. support of Israel and its war against Hamas. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke to Tony Pfaff. He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Iraq Initiative and asked him why the Iran-backed militias in Iraq appear to be changing their tactics.
That's a really good question. If you recall, back in January when Kataib Hezbollah attacked Tower 22 in Jordan, killing three American soldiers, Shortly after that attack, they made an announcement saying they were going to cease those kinds of attacks. They did not want to embarrass the Iraqi government, and they would not retaliate if the United States should retaliate. There was a sense at the time that not only the Iraqi government started exerting pressure on them for that kind of escalation, even Tehran was a little worried about crossing a line and escalating too much with the United States while they're in the middle of, you know, the crisis in Gaza. So you saw a drop off in attacks against U.S. soldiers. So I think you're right, because now what they can do is take advantage of popular sentiment that's anti-Israel, popular sentiment that is anti-U.S. support for Israel, and then make it appear as though this is a popular uprising. This is a popular response that accomplishes the goal that they have, which is to put pressure on the U.S. presence in the Middle East in general, but in Iraq in specific, to diminish it, if not drive it out. So this is them taking advantage of the current political situation in a way that they think will allow them to deflect their responsibility and thus avoid the kind of pressure the Iraqi government might otherwise bring on them, or, you know, the kind of retaliation the United States might engage in.
Well, you were telling me a bit earlier that you were in Iraq yourself about 2 months ago. So when you talk about these Iran-backed militias trying to engage in what they hope will be a popular movement, how popular is that kind of sentiment, criticizing the U.S. for its support of Israel and trying to damage U.S. businesses?
Well, it's another good question. My sense is that there's not a lot of Iraqi support for the Iran-backed militias. The Iraqi government, I believe, I don't want to be speaking for them, or the Iraqi people. However, there's a strong sense they just don't want to be in the middle of a fight between or a conflict between Iran and the United States. They have no interest in that. They want to posture themselves as an opportunity rather than a problem. So there's not a lot of support for what the Iran-backed militias are doing. And I think that was kind of shrinking or diminishing their ability to operate to some degree. But with what's going on in Gaza, there is a strong Iraqi sentiment, like I said earlier, that some of these attacks could be spontaneous. I doubt it very seriously. It wouldn't be very difficult for the militias to portray it as such and just take advantage of the opportunity to attack these softer targets as a way of diminishing the U.S. presence and an increasing anti-U.S. sentiment.
Well, you also just said that Iraq wants to be seen as a place of business opportunity. How much credibility is there to that notion that they are open for international businesses like KFC from the U.S.?
So this is the problem, right? So in terms of the impact to U.S. businesses, you know, a lot of what are described as U.S. businesses, you know, it's a franchise or a license through a foreign, often Iraqi company. So really, there's not a lot of revenue coming out of Iraq to the United States through the businesses they're attacking, from what I can tell. However, there's revenue being generated that's staying inside of Iraq that's now going to be denied. So the ones that these militias are really harming, the Iraqis who are working and owning these businesses are sort of the first, you know, set of casualties to this. But also the Iraqi prime minister's clear message when he visited a few months ago was, you know, we want to attract U.S. businesses to Iraq.
This is when he visited the U.S.
This is when he visited the U.S. and came to Washington, even went to Houston. And they even signed memorandums of understanding with about a dozen U.S. companies to help them, you know, not just develop, you know, the energy sector, but other sectors as well. This kind of security situation, of course, it's going to dampen the enthusiasm for that, I think. Now, you know, some companies may find ways to get around that by just having a shell or a group working for them in Iraq that isn't branded American. But overall, this is not good for Iraq's future economic prospects, I don't think.
VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Tony Pfaff of the Atlantic Council. And finally, today, while not a global crisis to all, it is indeed a crisis to some. Pakistan lost to arch-rival India by 6 runs in the Cricket World Cup tournament. What made Sunday's game most interesting, however, was that it was played in New York. That's going to wrap up today's program. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.